Welcome to the Construction Industry Podcast. Fresh ideas for today's construction professional. The Construction Industry Podcast is brought to you by Remontech, Remote Monitoring Technologies. Find us on the web at constructionindustrypodcast.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Construction Industry Podcast. This is episode 38. This is the show dedicated to helping you navigate the waters of the construction industry. Whether you're starting your career right now, have been in the construction industry for years, or if you're a construction project owner or a construction business owner, there's always something new we can all learn about our beautiful construction industry. On today's show, I bring to you attorney John Sire from Kitch Attorneys and Counselors, and we're going to talk about the topic of Integrated Project Delivery, or IPDs. So hello everybody once again, and I'd like to start off with a little bit of an update here, a little bit of news as it relates to the Construction Industry Podcast. I have decided to change the pace here a little bit. I originally had committed myself to a weekly show, but this has been really hard to do with all the other things going on with Remontech and also my personal life. There's a lot of stuff going on. And as you have noticed, it's been kind of hard to keep up with the weekly show. So instead of stressing myself out for failing to publish weekly, I decided to change the frequency of the Construction Industry Podcast to basically one every other week. So from now on, you can expect the podcast to be basically a bi-weekly show. This decision has already helped me, you know, in psychologically speaking, has made it much easier for me to plan for the shows at a pace that is much more comfortable for me. So while in theory you would get less episodes, they will be much more consistent and also of more quality. And my theory is that you're not going to get any less episodes than you're getting right now. So fear not. So in any case, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. So feel free to go to today's post on the page. If you go to remontech.com/039 and leave a comment there at the bottom of the show notes for this episode. Let me know what you think. I'd love to get some feedback from you on this. Now, let's talk about today's show. But before I introduce the guest, I'd like to let you know ask you to stay tuned for after the interview. I'm going to give you an update on something that I mentioned last time. And at the very end of the show, there is one more thing that our guest had to share. Very cool thing about the building in which we conducted the interview. So you have to listen until the end for that one. John Sire is an attorney with Kitch Attorney and Counselors and concentrates his practice in dispute avoidance and resolution of commercial, healthcare, and construction contract issues as the head of the firm's construction and commercial litigation group. In the construction industry, he analyzes the legal aspects of various project delivery methods and assists in project completion and dispute resolution. He received his Juris Doctor and Master of Arts in Mass Communication and Journalism from Drake University Law School and Graduate School in 1986, and his AB in Political Science and Communications from Loyola University of Chicago in 1983. He has published and presented on construction, healthcare, and commercial issues across the country. And John spoke with me in person at his office in downtown Detroit. Enjoy.
And now, our feature segment.
Hello, John. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent.
Thank you for so much for having me. I'm here in your one of your conference rooms here in person, mm-hmm. which is kind of unusual for the podcast, but it's always good to see face to face and talk about these topics. So thanks for having me here in Detroit.
Welcome to Detroit.
We can see Canada from
right,
I think, yeah. across the river. And later on, I want you to tell a little bit about this building. It's kind of an interesting story. So if you're listening, just wait until the end. We'll try to talk about that a little bit. So John, you're an attorney that's involved with construction. So can you tell us and the audience a little bit about your background and where you come from and how you got to be to where you are today in the construction industry?
Okay. I am a graduate of Loyola University in Chicago, undergraduate in Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, for my law degree, and I have a master's in journalism. Moved to Detroit in 1986 and started working in the construction related fields, representing universities, different size contractors and things like that, and have just continued that development today. And by and large, our firm represents primarily owners and primarily institutional owners, healthcare institutions and higher ed. We have some contractors and some designers, but the primary focus has been on the owners. And there we do front-end contract drafting, assist with project delivery method, and then evaluating contract performance and handling claims and enforcing contracts at the end.
Cool. And we met at the Construction Owners Association of America conference, spring conference, yep, last year. Yep. Which was I had an episode dedicated to that. I interviewed one of them, mm-hmm, one of the VPs there.
And we are associate counsel to COA.
Perfect. So great association, great, mm-hmm, institution. I really enjoyed that conference. Very different from what I'm used to.
Yeah. Well, so we'll come back to the one in Atlanta in May.
Yeah. It's on my to-dos. I think I might go, actually.
All right. We'll save a spot.
All right. Maybe we'll fly together. Now, John, you were, from what I understand, you're involved with IPD, which stands for Integrated Project Delivery. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is and how it's different from other delivery methods?
Well, there are probably as many definitions of IPD and integrated project delivery as there are people who say that they're performing it. There was a white paper a couple years ago that was jointly authored by the AIA, AGC, COA, National Association of State Facility Administrators, so a lot of owner groups, some design groups and construction groups got together to discuss what IPD really is. And there were some prior papers by the AIA and some others, but they wanted to consolidate this. And they came up with the notion that IPD is both a philosophy and a project delivery method. And as a philosophy, there are behavioral principles like collaboration, open communication, mutual trust and respect. And then there's also contractual principles where it talks about waivers of liability and open book contracting, fiscal transparency, things like that. And then there's the catalysts for IPD. And one of them is a multi-party agreement. So sometimes, like under consensus docs or even the AIA forms, it's a three-party agreement where the owner, architect, and constructor sign the same document. It's also another catalyst is BIM, the Building Information Modeling, for the level of communication that goes on in an IPD project is far beyond a traditional design bid build, but it even goes beyond a construction management where you have an early involvement of a CM, because you're usually bringing in the subcontractors and the major trades early on in the design phase in an IPD project. So it's interesting with IPD that you're usually not just designing to a budget, because that's always the architect's challenge, but everyone owns the project target cost estimate. So everyone has a stake in achieving the project goals and coming up with the best design that can be constructed. So you get the contribution from the subcontractors on improving the design of their particular component earlier on. So it's all, it's part of incorporating concepts of lean as applied to construction and applying those to a particular project.
Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say that there's a shared risk and reward among the stakeholders here that is different from when people are working against each other in other projects, but here everybody's together, so they share the pains and the laurels
right.
as well.
Okay. That's one of the contractual principles is that notion of sharing the risk and reward. Mm-hmm. And it's more common in IPD. It's not critical, but it's part of changing the mindset that if you're shifting or allocating responsibility or risk, a lot of times, whether it's between the owner and the constructor or the constructor and the subcontractor, they move risk away. And with IPD, if you share the risk and you manage the risk, you're probably going to have fewer bad outcomes. Because it's not the game of hot potato. It's where everybody's taking some level of ownership and saying through collaboration, through open communication, through mutual respect and trust, we will manage this risk and we'll get past it. But on the flip side, that collaboration does not excuse or eliminate accountability. So you still have that level of accountability and responsibility. You're just trying through the collaboration and through the more open communication to say, all right, we have a risk and we can manage it so this risk doesn't come to fruition. And then at the end, if we've managed it effectively, there may be a reward. You know, usually there's an incentive program where if it comes in under budget or there's several other criteria that may get worked into an incentive program like safety, minority participation, local business participation, things like LEED certification that may come into an incentive program. And if all of the risks are effectively managed, there's money left at the end, then you've got funding for an incentive program.
Okay, so the incentive pool I read about?
Yep.
Okay. Now, in this model, since these different parties are participating into the design phase as well, how are they, like let's say the constructor and the subcontractors, how are they chosen to be on the project if they're not, are they still bidding for their work?
Typically, and this is also something that's more common in IPD, there is a selection process that includes the entire team. So sometimes with a traditional design bid build, you select the architect does the drawings, put the drawings out for bid, and that's how you select the general contractor. In a CM agreement, you select the architect does the initial drawings, then the CM is brought in to try and optimize the drawings. Mm-hmm. With integrated project delivery, you select the team, and the team would include the designer, the constructor, and certain of the major trades. So depending on the project, it could be the mechanical, the plumbing, the electrical, structural steel. But depending on how much money is going into other trades, you may bring in other trades as well. But those trades tend to have the greatest impact on the budget, so they also have the greatest impact on the design. And by bringing them in earlier, you aren't left with some value engineering decisions that could occur on a CM project or a GC project, where you're pulling money out of mechanical by either downgrading the equipment or making some other qualitative change as well as quantitative change to reduce the price. Mm-hmm. Whereas with IPD, there may be other ways to manage it at that design phase to keep the mechanical system the way it was intended, but you can adjust other things in order to maximize the outcome for the owner. So having the trade contractors involved as early as possible is part of the lean process, and helps to improve the overall quality of the designs, especially when the owner's fairly clear on what outcome they want.
Okay. So, and how are these the trades, and how are they brought in? How are they chosen at the beginning? Is it any different than the typical?
Yeah, it's typically, they try not to have it be an arranged marriage. Mm-hmm. So that the parties have either worked together before, uh-huh, or they have some familiarity with each other. So that, the owner's not dictating this is who you're going to play with, mm-hmm, for the next period of time.
Right.
So it's a process that takes into account intangibles like chemistry. They may be very well skilled and they may be very experienced, but they may also be very demanding. It's like, okay, well, how well do they play with others in the sandbox? And that's more critical,
yeah,
when you get into IPD, because you have decisions being made by committee, by a core group. And the core group can include the designer and the constructor as well as the owner. So how well do they get along together? How well do they work together? That is something that an owner will consider as being very critical in determining who gets to play.
And this to me is really interesting, because this approach is very different from what I used to. I don't, mm-hmm, usually participate in bids, because our service is kind of, it's usually an afterthought. We come on board after project started. But the few times that I had to participate, it was not the most pleasant experience, try to,
right,
to win based on price only, lowest bid. There's so many ways for that to go wrong.
Yes.
So this approach is so much more how actual other businesses work. Mm-hmm. You get hired or you get invited to participate based on your previous experience or previously working with the other, mm-hmm, stakeholders, and so you can actually get hired by the value that you bring, not by the price that you happen to be the lowest, and that,
right,
that was the only criterion.
There's still, the price is still a major consideration, but, mm-hmm, a lot of times it's more the owner saying, here is my budget and here is what I want. Mm-hmm. How much of what I want can be delivered in this budget?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different approach than saying, here is what I want, tell me how much it's going to be,
yeah,
and if it's over my budget, we're going to start over again.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a little different in that approach, where it's more focused on the outcome than just the meeting this budget number, because, mm-hmm, when you're bidding to a hard dollar, from a constructor's standpoint, you're going to put contingencies in there, right, to protect yourself against things going sideways.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that contingency ends up being waste, because if the event never occurs, okay, the contractor's made more money, and that's a good thing. But from an owner's perspective, you've gotten no value from that.
Right.
So in this sense, by sharing that risk a little bit, and allowing the constructor to remove the contingencies, now you're paying for the actual cost of the work that's going in, and it results in a higher value. You're not paying for waste anymore. You're not paying because somebody else is carrying a risk.
That's brilliant. The incentive pool is basically the incentive for the contractors, subcontractors to keep their to keep lean.
Yes,
because they benefit from it.
Some of them, depending on how they participate, will also put either their fee or profit at risk, and say, yeah, there's an incentive pool, but if we consume that incentive pool, you know, the next layer is the constructor's fee. So if they have some things that consume the incentive pool and now the costs are still increasing, next thing you know, their fee is going to start contributing towards the cost of construction.
Yeah.
So they may do the work, and you know, the cost of the work, the direct cost of the work, would be paid, but their fee could end up getting consumed by the overruns. So there's where you get that shared risk on their part, mm-hmm. where, you know, because a lot of times an owner looks at something that appears to be a cost plus with no guaranteed max or no fixed price, and they say, well, wait a second, cost plus is a license to print money.
Right.
And here it's like, well, you know, no, it's not a license to print money. It's a license to do a job effectively. And then if the costs go over what they should, what everybody's anticipated and what they're responsible for, okay, that's just going to reduce the amount of money that the constructor will make.
Right.
And sometimes the designer participates in that as well.
Yeah. My dad's a civil engineer. He grew up, I grew up hearing this, you know, that a change or anything that changes in a contract or any additions, anything that makes the price go up, it's good news for those involved, you know, that subcontracted. Mm-hmm. And it's not like that anymore in IPD, because everybody loses when the costs go up.
Yeah, and typically the changes aren't as frequent,
mm-hmm.
because there have been so many people involved in the design.
Yeah.
That they've talked through all of the different options. So when you get to a certain point, the changes in an IPD project tend to be more owner-driven at that point, where an owner says, you know what, circumstances have changed from when we started to now, and so I need to alter this, whether it's room size or finishes or what that room is ultimately going to be used for, that, you know, I need to change that from an observation area to an operating room, or something like that, where there's been a programming change versus an unforeseen site condition. Mm-hmm. Those usually have been worked out by then. You know, they've figured out how they were going to address that, so they've managed it. And really, that wouldn't necessarily be a change in the sense of changing or altering the program. It would just be a cost of the work. And now you'd be managing or affecting the project contingency that's shared by everybody, that's another level or layer in this overall compensation. So when the parties agree to this, whether you call it project target, cost estimate, or whatever terminology you use, there are various layers in that, where there's the estimate of the actual construction cost, and then on top of that would be either a design contingency or construction contingency, then an incentive layer, and then you get into the pain share. So you've got different pools or layers of money on the project that you're drawing from, that in a design bid build project would probably result in a change order, because mm-hmm. I've got a hard dollar bid. Now they've encountered a site condition that's going to require additional work that wasn't in the original drawings. All right, there's a change order because of that. In an IPD, that wouldn't result in a change order. Right. That would just be an increased cost of the work. You've consumed a chunk of a layer that's there, but the scope hasn't really changed. The right. only scope changes are programmatic.
What if that layer is consumed completely? What happens then?
Then you, depending on how you've layered it, if the incentive layer is also the contingency, mm-hmm. okay, and you've consumed the contingency, now you're into the pain share, where potentially fees and profits are at risk.
I see.
And it depends on, you know, how you've treated the contingency and how you've managed the contingency. But yeah, that as it moves up that scale, that's when you start getting closer to people putting profits at risk.
So what's the flow of the decision making in IPD?
A lot of times, depending on the project, but the general characteristic is that it will go from the field up to a core group, and then above the core group is a management group. And the core group would be the people that were empowered to make kind of the day-to-day type decisions. Or validate them, and then over them would be the management group, which may include more senior level people who would be making more the strategic type of decisions. Now in the consensus docs 300 and some other document forms, the owner retains the ultimate say-so. If you look at some of the other international forms, like the Australian version of IPD is similar to, I think they call it partnering, or they have another term for it, where it's really the decisions are by the group. So there's no one person who has veto power over the others. In the U.S., when it comes to construction, owners are very reluctant to say, I'm not the final word on this. So typically the owner will make or will be empowered to make the final decision, whether it's the majority's view or not. But if they go against the majority, that would go through the dispute resolution process that's laid out in the IPD agreement as well.
I see. So I can see how a person like you would be very valuable in an IPD project because of all these agreements and things like that. Can you tell us a little bit how your work fits into this whole dynamic?
The role of attorneys and auditors and other folks, we almost become referees is probably too connotative of a word, but while on the one hand we're representing our respective clients, the goal is to advance the project and to have an agreement that reflects the intent of all of the parties to have a successful project outcome. In a design bid build setting, typically the goal, while on the one hand the goal is to have a successful project, on the other hand it may be to shift as much risk as possible to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And that's one way that people view design bid build. Is, all right, here's my drawings. You said you can build to these drawings. If it costs you more than that, that's your problem. You know, I have shifted that risk of cost overruns to you. and I don't want any responsibility for it. If something happens on the site, you know, we're going to have discussions about it, but ultimately, you know, it's going to be your problem. Our role as attorneys in implementing the contractual principles of IPD, it's a learning process, because some owners and some constructors and some designers are risk averse. You know, they don't like taking on risk that they don't specifically control. And the idea or the notion to encourage the parties is to say, well, you don't individually control all of these risks, but collectively you can manage them. And that's the difference. You know, trying to say, don't just dump the risk onto somebody else, but figure out what's the best way to manage that risk so that it's mitigated or avoided altogether. And then you've got the insurance role. And there are more insurance products coming out for integrated project delivery. And some of the insurance products had been developed for like design build. And design build is very similar, except for the level of owner involvement. IPD requires a much higher level of owner involvement than a design build project. Because some design build projects, you could also call them turnkey, where the owner basically says, here's what I want, call me when it's done, and I'll write you a check. You know, whatever decisions are made, you guys make those decisions, and I'll show up when I'm taking possession of the building. IPD, the design hasn't even been developed yet. The program was. So the design is being developed with the owner's input, with the designer's input, with the constructor's input, and the trade contractor's input, you know, almost in real time. It's a lot different than design build, but there are enough common elements there that the insurance markets are developing products that are now for integrated project delivery. And some insurance carriers are recognizing that with managed risk, there are lower possibilities of claims. So they've priced it accordingly. And to this point, and I'm probably going to jinx it, but to this point, there haven't been any serious claims on an IPD project. And whether that's because IPD is the greatest thing, or the principles of IPD, the behavioral principles of IPD, with the collaboration, open communication, and the mutual trust and respect, tends to resolve those issues before they become claims.
Mm-hmm. Out of curiosity, is a corporation established for this project, or and that corporation hires a service like yours, or how does that? Who's your client?
Typically, our client would be the owner.
Okay.
An IPD model that the AIA developed that utilized or created a single purpose entity. Mm-hmm. And that single purpose entity would include the owner, the designer, and the constructor. And that single purpose entity would develop the project. There were some legal tax and liability issues with that, because that single purpose entity would then have to hold separate contracts with the designer and with the constructor, so you just created a new owner. Because right. When it comes to like professional liability insurance, the holder of the insurance can't also be the claimant. You know, there's what's called a moral hazard. So the architect can't file a claim on his own professional liability insurance. Mm. It has to be a third party. So that's why you were forced to now have this separate contract. So that model ended up not being quite as effective as it was originally hoped. So now the new model, or the model as it's developed, is a multi-party agreement. Now, they've started out as three-party agreements, but there's a gentleman like Will Lichtig, who is one of the disciples of IPD. He has had multi-party agreements where he's had more than a dozen parties signing the same contract. So it would be the owner, the designer, the designer's consultants, the constructor, trade contractors, anybody who was critical to the success of the project was signing the same agreement. Now, with a three-party agreement, you have the owner, constructor, and designer signing the same agreement, and then you may have consultants signing joining agreements, which were supplements to their subcontracts, but they weren't necessarily a party to the agreement. And that's an evolving practice right now. Howard Ashcraft is another proponent of IPD out of Hanson Bridget in California. He also uses the multi-party approach and has different perspectives on different projects, whether or not to add additional parties to the base contract or to have them brought in through joining agreements or other types of subcontract agreements.
I see. Are the unions usually also part of this, or how where do they fit?
They can be, depending on the project and depending on where you're at. Mm-hmm. There is the concept of a project labor agreement. And the federal government has an executive order that on federal projects over a certain dollar amount, there should be a project labor agreement in place. All that would do really is add the trade council or the unions potentially as a party to the IPD agreement. And there's nothing that would necessarily prohibit that, other than, maybe the union's reluctance to sign on to a construction contract where they're not, they aren't employing the laborers, they're supplying the laborers. So there's certain things that they may not want to be responsible for, but to the extent that they want to participate in the success of a project, now, have we heard about any backlash? Typically not. In fact, on some of the public projects that have utilized IPD, they've been very tolerant, because it's not always so price sensitive, and sometimes that's where the union gets very defensive, because there's the argument that non-union labor costs less than union labor, when the participation isn't solely on price, then they tend to feel a little bit more comfortable with it.
It just sounds to me that it just changes the whole dynamic of a construction project when this is in place, huh?
It does, and it's intended to, and it can be difficult to change that mindset when people are so accustomed to the silo thinking and silo behavior that, this is my responsibility, I'm not going to step out of my silo and look at, if I'm a constructor, I'm not going to get involved in design. And if I'm a designer, I'm not going to tell the constructor how to build this. And if I'm an electrical contractor, I'm not going to look at the way that the plumber is doing his job. I'm going to be worried about me, I'm going to put on blinders, and that's just the way I've always done it. I'm hired to do what I'm supposed to do. IPD blurs those distinctions. And one of the catalysts of IPD is co-location. And having the design team and the constructing team in the same physical location as the designs are being developed, you know, cuts down on RFIs because you don't have to. You know, you have that open level of communication where if there's an issue that the electrical contractor doesn't understand on the drawings or sees a conflict in the drawings, he can walk, you know, down the hall or across the room to the designer and say, look, I've got this problem. How are we going to fix this? And then one of the other catalysts of IPD being building information modeling, now you've created an ability to catch a lot of conflicts that, you know, otherwise might not have been caught if everybody's looking at their own set of drawings. So once you layer them and you create the BIM design model, now the program starts catching the conflicts. And you can make the changes while it's still in virtual space versus in three-dimensional space, or as you're building it and you discover the conflict.
And they're all under the same roof, so if there is a conflict or an interference of some sort, you can just call the electrical contractor.
It's a lot faster than, you know, a subcontractor writing up an RFI, sending the RFI to the constructor, the constructor reviewing it and determining that he can't answer the question, and then passing it along to the designer, who then the designer takes it and then they pass it along to the whatever discipline needs to respond to it, and then the answer comes back. It, you know, can be days or longer, versus, you know, bringing the topic up as it's discovered and getting it resolved, not necessarily always in a matter of minutes, but getting it resolved a lot faster than days or weeks.
And I can see also a better sense of community as well, because they're all sharing the same space, they get to know each other, and that also helps, I'm assuming, communication.
They still, it's interesting because a lot of times they'll still use the phrase war room, you know, when they describe the, and usually the phrase war room is more because it looks like chaos.
Right.
Because you've got diagrams and plans and schedules pinned up to the wall, and they may be covered with sticky notes, and there's just a lot of activity. Not that it's the situation for conflict. Kind of looks like the in the movie Dr. Strangelove. You know, you can't fight in the war room,
right? Yeah, but you know, they hammer things out right there, and then, you know, instead of later on when you know, in the mud out there in the construction site, when,
right,
you know, things don't quite match, and
right. So you're dealing with a virtual world, where changes are cheap. Versus in the real world, where you've already got materials on the site, you've got a crew that's waiting for an answer, and they can't move forward until they get an answer and figure out how to resolve a conflict in the field.
Great. Now, do you see IPD becoming more prevalent, or how do you see the future of it?
I think the principles of IPD will become more prevalent, whether it's the behavioral principles or the contractual principles. I think the catalysts of IPD with the multi-party agreement and the co-location and the BIM will become more common as it moves along. I think people are seeing a benefit from it. Part of the difficulty is going to be moving into the public sector, because as you move into the government sector, there's enabling legislation that would have to be implemented, because a lot of times in many states the mandate is a separate contract for construction and a separate contract for design, and that's rooted in the historic notion that we have to keep the fox from guarding the hen house.
Right.
So if we put everything, all of our faith in the constructor, well, then he's gonna, he's got nobody watching him, so he could steal from us. And if we don't have anybody watching the designer, then, you know, we could get deficient services from them. So that type of attitude would need to have to be adjusted a little bit so that there would be more enabling legislation that would empower either local or state governments to start utilizing IPD more. There is some movement towards design build, particularly in transportation, on civil projects and things like that. And that, like I said, that transition from design build to IPD is not that great. It's more a matter of implementing the principles and with greater owner involvement. Public-private partnerships is another one that would benefit from IPD. But whether it would be legally possible would be challenging for that to move to the public sector. Right now, it's growing in healthcare because healthcare, in part, is looking for a way to improve processes, to enhance value for the same amount of money. You know, the pressures on healthcare entities to do more with less. You know, reimbursements going down, but their obligations are increasing. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to find a way to, you know, all of their processes to get as much as possible with as little as possible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a future for it. It's just where exactly and in what form.
Very good. Well, John, this was really informative. I certainly learned a lot. I'm sure the audience is going to learn a lot as well from this interview. When we first started talking, I thought we were going to be talking about law, but then you suggested IPD, and I said, yes, I want to learn more about that. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who want to learn more, but they're afraid to ask. So I think you gave us some very good information there. So thank you very much.
And there are a lot of people out there that have done several IPD projects and a lot of lessons learned. So it's there are a lot of resources that are available.
Okay. What I'll do is after we're done here, maybe I'll ask you for some links or white papers that you can share with the community here. So, John, if people want to learn more about you, about your company, where should they go?
They can go to our website, which is kitch.com, KITCH.com, and then they can. My listing is on the website under the attorneys section, so they can pull that up by looking me up at John Sier, S-I-E-R.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
So I do recommend to check out the resources available with the show notes for today's episode. And again, you can visit remontech.com/039 for all the links that John mentioned during the interview and some others as well that he has sent me afterwards. Now, what about you? Do you have any experience with IPDs? I'd love to hear your thoughts. This is something that's relatively new, so I'd love to hear your thoughts and a bit of your experience. So if you head on over to constructionindustrypodcast.com and you will see a little tab on the right side of the screen that says send us a voicemail. You can click there and follow the instructions and you can do it right from your computer. You don't need to call any number or anything. You can just use your built-in microphone. Or you can just type a comment under the show notes for this episode, again, at remontech.com/039. And Remontech is spelled R-E-M-O-N-T-E-C-H. Now, one of the updates I'd like to give you is I will be speaking at our local Project Management Institute chapter here in southwestern Ontario, Canada, on the value of having an online presence and platform for project managers. As you know from last episode, this was one of my goals for the year, to speak at more conferences. And I'm still working on presenting at a construction themed conference, but I just started looking at that, so I can't really tell you that it has materialized yet. But if you think I'd be a good fit for a conference, like I mentioned last time, a conference that you're a part of or a conference that you attend, send me a note at through the website, or you can just send me a note at feedback@constructionindustrypodcast.com. For the PMI conference where I'll be speaking, there's still not a whole lot of information online about it, as they're still trying to organize it. But I'll make sure I'll share it with you as soon as it's available, in case you're interested in having an online platform as a project manager. So that's it for today's show. So thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to personally thank iTunes user Dane the Mang for the awesome review that he left me there in iTunes. And I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but at the end there, he tells me to keep up the good work. I'm trying. So I hope this was a good show, good episode, and keeping up the good work as you suggested. So thank you so much for that feedback. Now, if you benefit from the Construction Industry Podcast, consider going over to iTunes and leaving a rating or a review there. It really helps to create visibility for the show, and it brings more listeners as a result. And also, I'd like to remind you that my name is Cesar Vade, and I'm the project manager for Remontech Construction Camera Specialists. We know everything there is to know about setting up cameras to record and monitor construction project. I'd love an opportunity to work personally with you on your construction project. So if you're involved in a commercial or industrial construction project and believe that a live feed, time-lapse video recording, and a little bit of scheduling consulting could be beneficial to your project, drop us a line at myconstructioncamera.com. The next episode, I speak with Luke Nixa, a construction project manager, fellow project management professional, and a safety training program manager. We will have a chat about construction safety. He's a great guest because besides being deep into the construction industry, he's also a volunteer firefighter and a field instructor for the state of Iowa with the Fire Service Training Bureau. So he sees all sides of safety issues when things go right and when things go wrong. So stay tuned. And once again, thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
So John, we're sitting here in your office building, and this building has a bit of an interesting history. Can you share with us what's this building all about?
This the American Natural Resources Building, or One Woodward in Detroit, was designed by the Minoru Yamasaki Studios that were located in Detroit back in the 60s. And it was built before the World Trade Center, and actually is a 1/4 scale model of the World Trade Center, with the elongated diamond windows, two-story open glass lobby area, and so a lot of the design features that were in the World Trade Center were developed here. The exterior support with the central core. So this building kind of was a proof of concept for Yamasaki, so that when he took his ideas and enlarged them for the World Trade Center buildings, it was very similar. So on 9/11, we saw a lot of things that were eerily familiar when the Trade Center buildings collapsed.
And this is my second time in here, and the first time I was in here, everything looked so familiar to me, and I couldn't put my finger on it. The windows and the lobby, and then when you told me that, it all of a sudden it made sense. So this is basically a 1/4 scale model of the World Trade Center.
This is a 27 stories if you include the mechanical floor. And the World Trade Centers were 105, 106.
And the footprint as well? Is it a quarter?
If you go the rough dimensions, The city blocks in New York were much larger than the block area that we're in here in Detroit, because the way Detroit is designed is spokes of a wheel, and the hub of that wheel is only a couple blocks away. So the blocks closer to the hub are much smaller than they are as you move away. So yeah, in Manhattan, if you took this building and enlarged it four times, that's generally the footprint.
Fascinating. I'll put some pictures that I took last time on onto the show notes for this episode, so people can see.
And don't forget then there's the statue up front of the Paso de Danzo. The dancer is actually a sculpture of the sculptor's wife. And part of the some of the jokes that would happen back in the 60s and 70s is you have the Spirit of Detroit that's over by the City County Building, and that's a Marshall Fredericks sculpture, which is a large copper sculpture of a man who is clothed only in a towel. And periodically people would paint big green footsteps from that sculpture over to our sculpture across the street. So
very good, very good.